Welcome to episode 169 of the Not Your Mama's Gamer podcast, a podcast where we talk about games and gaming from a feminist perspective. My name is Samantha Blackman, and I'm an associate professor here at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana, where I talk about, read about, write about, dream about, amongst other things, video games. We are joined tonight by a special podcast guest, as well as a regular co-host, but we'll start with a special guest tonight. We have with us Kevin Harwood, who is the creative director and producer of the game The Station, which is done by The Station Games. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. Kevin, how are you today? Let's start with that.
I'm doing so well. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So tell us a little bit about who you are and a little bit about your project.
Yeah, so I'm Kev. I'm up here in Vancouver, Canada. I work on the indie and big game circuit around North America. Gaming industry is so small a community, as you guys so well know, so I just get paradropped onto a ton of games here and there, usually, interesting enough, in the marketing component. So this is actually my first project leading a production.
Nice. Well, it's a good project to lead, apparently.
Oh, thank you.
We're also joined by our regular co-host, Alicia Carabinas. Alicia, how are you, darling?
I'm okay. I'm going to be probably quieter than usual because early springtime is bad asthma time for me, and Indiana's trying to kill me, so there's just a preview of what you're not going to hear because I'm going to mute it. So I get to say something very exciting this time. I'm Alicia Carabinas. I'm a PhD student at Purdue University, and I only have maybe one more podcast in which I'm going to say I'm a PhD student, because right after that I defend my prospectus. And obviously I'm going to leave that moment a PhD candidate.
Yes, obviously you will.
Obviously. We're not leaving until I'm a candidate, so that's where we live until I am.
Well, we'll make sure you're out of there, because I want to stay there all day. All right. So we're going to go through our usual what you're playing, what you're reading, what you're drinking, and we'll go through fairly quickly. I say that, and I mean it this time, because we really want to get into talking to Kev about, yes, about The Station. So, and we're going to pretend we have some manners around here, and we'll start with Kevin. Kev, what are you playing lately?
You know what? When it comes time to launch, you don't really play games. They just sort of play you. You just try and, like, de-stress as much as you can. So I've been PUBG-ing hard. I've been dropping, and it's been nuts. I also recently just had PlayStation send me one of their VR dev kits, and I'm not actually sure if I'm supposed to say that. Never mind. So they didn't. And I've just been playing a random PlayStation dev kit, and I've been playing a ton of Superhot and Skyrim in VR, just anything I can get my hands on in Skyrim or in VR.
Oh, there's some pretty cool looking stuff in PlayStation VR. There's the cute little RPG game that has the mouse called, like, Moss. I saw that, and I was really tempted to get a PlayStation VR kit, but I've got a history of VR headsets making me real nauseous. So, but I haven't tried the PlayStation one yet, so I'm gonna have to go somewhere and try one before I, like, actually buy one. So,
you know what? That's fascinating you say that, because I got Oculus sent me their DK2 mm-hmm. back, I don't know, 4 years ago, and to me, I was so excited when I took it out of the box, and then I quickly figured out that it's just a really expensive vomit simulator, and I had to put it down immediately. Because, I mean, who would have thought when you're sitting in a basement on a roller coaster simulator, it wouldn't go very well? The amount of times people would come down into my basement and play bullet dodge and smash their head on the table, it was unreal. So I quickly retired that device, but then the PlayStation VR is... I mean, they're not paying me to say this, but it is incredibly well done. It is such a step
heard
forward.
Better things. Yeah,
I might have to try that, because some of the stuff coming out on PlayStation VR looks really good.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And I will say this: I've had a lot of students who've studied this the motion sickness issue with VR. My students every semester do a big project where they have to come up with a solution to something, and this is something they're fascinated by. But I haven't had any of them study that product, but I have heard better things about it. So I might see if I can point some in that direction. Mm. See if they can figure out, you know, what's the difference.
The big thing that I can point you to is I know a lot of studios that specifically focus on VR. You've probably already seen this, but in the PlayStation Store for VR, there's only like 50 games.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of content right now, and it's mainly because they have such a high, strict standard of what actually makes it into the store. And the big thing that people struggle with is hitting, maintaining the 90 FPS the entire time on the standardized hardware. And so now that the games are coming out and they've been held to such a rigorous standard, they're great because you don't get sick.
Yeah, I might have to try that. Because, like I said, some of the games, because, like you said, there's not a whole lot of games, but what's in there looks really good. And I've been tempted, so.
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
Except for VR horror games, because I'm pretty sure that I would literally shit myself. And I'm not here for that.
You probably
Sam would. Has watched me play some intense horror games. It's not pretty.
Yeah, you probably would.
Or I would just cry a lot. It would be awful.
All right. Alicia, what about you, darling? What you been playing?
You know, I have been playing a whole lot of Slay the Spire. So it's this, I don't know, it's roguelike deck building game that I got for my birthday from a friend of mine who knows what I like, which are the best kind of friends to have. And it's so fun because you can play for like 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and then come back to it, which is the best kind of game for me because I can do it as a distraction while I'm working on other things. And it's amazing. Definitely recommend if you like to die over and over in horrible new ways. And if you like to grind just for the sake of grinding. I like to suffer, so this is my kind of game. I played The Station. What else have I been playing? I went back and I played a little bit of Metal Gear Solid 5, which I hadn't done in a while, but I had this sudden urge to like beat a bunch of men up without actually killing them. And that's how I play Metal Gear Solid 5. So that was a nice distraction. But I don't think I've played much lately because I've had so much work to do this semester. I think that pretty much covers everything. Oh, I played some Reigns Her Majesty, which is delightful and immediately different from the original Reigns in a lot of really good ways. Super feminist right out of the gate. Very snarky. I recommend that for everybody too.
Yeah, I played a lot of that when I was traveling. not last week, but the week before. Because I was on a plane, so I played a lot of that when I was traveling, and it was pretty fun.
Yeah, the self-awareness in that game, just right out of the gate, you're just like, damn. Like, oh, look, this queen is really effective. Let's kill her.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly. All right. So, well, I've been traveling a lot, so I haven't been playing a lot of larger games. I think we can put it that way because I've been carrying my Switch with me because I can, you know, move around with it and stuff. So I played this really cute, it's like a little tiny puzzle / point and click adventure game called One-Eyed, I'm going to slaughter this because it's from a little Russian studio, One-Eyed Kuthk, which is really fun. And it's a really super short game. I think I finished it in like an hour. And that was because I was trying to hit everything. I've been playing Mulaka as well, which is really fun. Folks are going to hear more about that, so I'm not going to go on and on about that because I'm going to go on and on about that other places a little later.
I'm ready to go on and on about it with you.
Yeah. PUBG. I've been playing a lot of PUBG. I get the PUBG bug, and then I don't want to play anything but PUBG. And that's kind of where I've been for like the last week or so since I've been home. I've been playing a lot of PUBG, like all the time. It's like, yeah, I got 20 minutes. Let's see who wants to play PUBG. And then 3 hours later, I'm still playing PUBG. And of course, The Station. I've been playing The Station. I played through, just kind of straight through the first time I played it. And I really enjoyed it, and it kind of blew my mind. So we're going to talk about that without talking about, the end, maybe?
But the end is so good. I really want to go back because there's some things I missed, and I didn't realize at the time that I wouldn't be able to go back to certain places, so I'm going to play it again.
Yep, that's why I had to go back, and I went back because I missed two achievements. So I had to go back. I had to go back because one of them was find all, I always caught them when I was playing, it's like, oh look, it's a glowy talkie orb. So So the voice recordings, I had to go back and find those, and then the other one will solve all the puzzles. And apparently somewhere I missed one of the puzzles because I still have not gotten that achievement.
Oh my God, I have to say, we're going to talk about this later, but I'm going to say it now while I'm thinking about it. I usually do not like puzzles in games, but I really enjoy these.
These were fun.
They were fun.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about the paintings.
Oh.
I'm going to warn you now. We're going to talk. I took screenshots of all the paintings.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, they were so good.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I've got to finish because I've got to get that last achievement in the station because I want to find out what that other puzzle was. I love puzzle games, so this was right up my alley. And so that's what I've been playing. What about reading? Is anybody reading anything interesting? What about you, Kev? Anything interesting? You know, not like you haven't been busy or anything.
Yeah, I love reading. My Christmas wish list was overbought. I was really happy. I've been reading through a weird eclectic mix of things. I don't know if you guys all know the latest Canadian celebrity Jordan Peterson. He's this free speech activist out in Toronto, and he published a book on how to not screw up your life. And so I've been reading through that. I've been interestingly reading through Pixar's latest book on creativity. I think it's 3 years old at this point now, but it's fantastic on how they run their production. I've been reading The Art of War by Sun Tzu. Because, you know, why not? This is the time, I suppose, to do it. I actually was given a book by my sister, who's a, she does Broadway, and she was researching a role or something, but I don't know how I got this in my head, but it's a book on the rise and fall of the Third Reich, written from the perspective of a Jewish journalist living in Berlin during the whole rise of it, who was a reporter for the BBC. So I've been swapping around between those books.
Oh, sounds like a good eclectic mix of books.
It's been not too bad.
Yeah. Cool. What about you, Alicia? What you reading, Darla?
Well, not Jordan Peterson. Actually, lately, I have just been reading a lot of theory, so I'm super boring. One of the members of my committee promised me a package of books basically if I am a good girl and read lots of Zizek, so... I've been reading a lot of Zizek and Judith Butler, so please send pain medicine, headache pills, and booze to my house.
I was gonna say booze.
Yes,
you definitely need booze with that.
But reading some of Judith Butler's stuff on critique and dissent has been really good. Like one of the essays that I've been reading, I've read before, but I have a new understanding of it now. But, I mean, as much as I like Judith Butler, she's a hard read even for me. I don't have the background that a lot of my colleagues do in, like, theory, because I switched to ret comp from creative writing, so it's a totally different thing. Mm-hmm. I'm still suffering every day. My elder child got this book to Nimona yesterday, mm-hmm. and he's already finished it, so I started it. And it's really good so far. It's a graphic novel. And apparently it's being made into a film. So I can recommend that. It's about a young shapeshifter. And it's a nice emotional story. But I don't know yet where it's going to go. But it's good. So that's my fun reading right now.
Well, the only, I think, new thing that I'm, what am I reading? Oh, I know what I'm reading. I'm reading Algorithms of Oppression by Sophia Noble, which is a really interesting book. And it was, the book was already on my radar, but I think after she started to catch crap about the book before it was even published from your usual dudes who were like, what are you talking about? Of course, technology is totally and completely objective, and there can't be any oppression in algorithms. Of course, this woman is making all this up, right? And then they were like, well, have you read the book? And they were like, no, but we know she's making it up. So after that, I was like, I have to throw money at this even if I'm like horrible. I'm like, I'm going to throw money at this no matter what. But the book is amazing. So That's what I've been reading lately. Haven't been doing a lot of reading because I've been doing so much traveling lately to give stupid talks. Not stupid talks. To give talks. So I haven't had a... I like giving talks. I shouldn't say stupid talks. I feel that way when I've been traveling a lot and I'm tired right. of traveling.
No, I want to talk about this book real quick.
Yes.
Because we actually had a project that we started in some class. Mm-hmm. Because we noticed some of the stuff that she talks about in Algorithms of Oppression,
yes.
right?
Yes,
like, our professor had us comparing just the kind of stuff that came, like, literally the information that you found, not the searches,
mm-hmm.
On, like, Cesar Chavez, Martin Luther King, and then some other activists. Mm-hmm. And we started to notice what, like, the autocomplete would put in.
Yes.
And it was interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we had a huge amount of notes. So I was both really excited and also somewhat disappointed to see that book up here, because I was like, damn, we were going to write an article, but also, look, we're validated. And I have my students recreate some of those exercises in class, right? Because I want them thinking about, like, how to read search results.
Yeah.
And not just accepting what the computer feeds to them. And this is the issue I have with a lot of, like, well, computers are totally pure, right? Because everything is programmed by a human, yeah. and we're all flawed. So, you know, shit happens.
Yeah.
But I'm really excited to read that book. That is next on my list.
Or even, you know, even the way, like, search engines learn, right? Because
they
do, right? I mean, if it was like less than 10 years ago that everybody was talking about how to Google bomb so that they could get, so you people could get the results that they wanted them, other people to get when they searched for a presidential candidate, for example, or, I mean, so I guess everybody's forgotten that already. Right. So now technology is pure and angelic once again, because everybody's forgotten Google bombing and also forgotten, you know what, people come to whatever they are doing, whatever they are programming, with their own thoughts, issues, and biases to begin with. Right.
Well, and plus, if the search engine learns you as, like, a human, like, when I search stuff about avatars, the search engines return things like, here are issues of representation with avatars, because the search engines know me.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're like, oh, this is Alicia. She's totally searching for some shit about representation.
Yeah.
But if I complete those same searches on a different computer or I'm not logged in, I get, you know, wildly different results. I Absolutely. Search for avatar and it's like Avatar, The Last Airbender, you know, I mean, it's like totally different.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's impossible to ignore, I mean, these systems are so entwined with who we are as humans that it's really interesting to consider, like, where the system ends and where the human begins and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you know what we're going to have to do? Once we're all done reading this book, because you're going to read it too. So once
we're going to have a round table.
Yeah, we're going to have a round table. We're going to talk about the book. That's going to be fun.
That's fine. I'm good with it.
So let's jump to the real fun part, is the what you're drinking part.
A lot, because of my cough.
That's a good excuse.
Oh, you said what? Not how much.
That's a good excuse.
She says, pouring more into her glass.
Kevin, I don't know if I warned you about the what you're drinking part. I don't know if that's in the guest document that I sent out. but
we're academics, so we drink a lot.
That's great.
It's like we have to. but you're in Canada, and that's like a requirement. I'm from Michigan, so I completely understand. So what are you drinking? Anything fun, interesting?
Well, recently, about a year ago, my closest friend married a hardcore German family. And so they sort of brought me into their German crew, and now I can't stop drinking German beer. It is so good. And I remember the first time I met the father of my friend's wife. He said, would you like a beer? And I said, yeah, or maybe a Corona or something. He said, oh, like, that's great. I can get you some dishwater, too, if you'd like that as well.
And I'm kind of with him on that one.
Yeah, I quickly figured out that I need to settle down, and I need to learn what this gentleman recommends is what I drink. And so at first, I was getting just wrecked by this gentleman's hardcore German lagers, and now I can't drink anything but it. And now I'll go to a bar, and someone hands me, you know, something lesser, and I'll just sort of, like, throw it at him and say, how dare you, it's dishwater. So it's the transformation is complete. I've also, in preparation for the next project we're working on, I'm having a lot of Glenfiddich.
Oh.
I feel like
that's a project I can get behind.
Yeah, I know. I want to do some research for this.
Nice. All right. Alicia, not how much are you drinking, but what are you drinking, darling?
Okay. Well, before I tell you, I do want to tell you that on Saturday I attended a class on brewing beer, which came with free beer, so it was very exciting. A little weird, a little like, I don't know, we just decided to see what the city needed, and we didn't know how to brew beer, so we started, which was, you know, like, privilege on parade, but whatever. Yeah. I did get to eat some malt, though, some, like, that was interesting. But now I know a lot more about how beer gets made, so I'm really excited, but I'm not drinking beer tonight. I am drinking whiskey ginger, because I can drink a lot of it, quickly. Which helps my chest. Look, I'm sorry. It's not that I'm just a crazy booze hound. It's just that I'm dying. I have chloroseptic. I have Robitussin. I can't have cough drops anymore because they're bad for my body. So it's like chloroseptic, Robitussin, and whiskey. All right? This is my life now. And I'll have my inhaler right here. And I have my super inhaled steroid inhaler also. So if you need to know what my life is right now, it's being a medicinal octopus.
That's always
super
nice.
Fun times.
That's nice though.
What are you drinking, Sam?
We are drinking buddies and twins apparently tonight because I am also drinking whiskey ginger. I
brought you into the fold.
You did. I actually found locally the Fever Tree ginger beer and not the ginger ale. Which is much better than the ginger ale.
BRB driving to Sam's.
They didn't have it at Sam's. I got this at...
No, I mean to your house.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I have some because I picked up a little extra. But the Fever Tree ginger beer, which has a little citrus and a whole lot of ginger bite to it. Unfortunately, it does come in these little teeny tiny bottles.
So
pop a lot of them. So I am drinking a Jack Daniel's and Fever Tree ginger beer because of the citrusiness of the ginger beer, the sour mash whiskey just kind of melds really well with it, and I'm all over that. So, but I'm pacing myself tonight because we have a guest, and I don't want to have like four of them and get sloppy. So I'm being good.
I'm not sorry, but. I can usually keep it together pretty well, so it'll be okay. Plus, I want you to like me, so, because I really like your game, so I'm going to be good.
Good job. He's like, oh my god, these women.
No, I had someone interview me, and they were just flat out drunk. They were drunk. And they were asking questions about things that I don't think a psychiatrist should ask about a marriage. So anyway, I think we're on a good
track.
We're
not going to do that. I promise you that, probably.
Yeah, we're usually pretty good.
At least an 85% probability.
Yeah. We're pretty good. We pace ourselves, and we have a rule that we usually don't start drinking until the podcast starts. So, usually, I don't know what Alicia's been doing tonight. All right. So, that takes us through which play, which read, and which...
I've been working.
Said she. So, let's talk about this game, which is pretty amazing. Because it's I love indie games. But everybody knows that because I'm playing indie games all the time. And so when this one like came on my radar, and I was like, it's a space game, right? And I like space games. I'm a huge to talk about AAA titles, right? I'm a huge Mass Effect fan. But then I also play like all the smaller like space games that come out, like the Tacomas, and like there's the new one that just came out like this week, like Surviving Mars or something, is on my radar, and I want to pick that one up. But then the Station, I was like, this looks really interesting, because I also, my kind of dirty little secret is that I love mysteries of all kinds, right? So when it was like sci-fi mystery on a space station, I was like, this has my name written all over it. Tell me this. This is the first question I have. Where did the idea for this game come from?
Yes, I want to know about the inspiration.
You know, it's always really awkward because I'm always wanting to say a really beautiful way, like I was lying in a bed of roses, and all of a sudden.
Oh, don't lie.
But no, it's I was actually at the plant store buying cactus mix, and I thought that would be sick. So that's really, it's sad, but that's really where it came from.
No, that's such a better answer.
Yes, I mean, cactus mix, that'll get you where you want to go.
No, I mean, before I, when I had time, before they put me in a PhD program and I didn't have any time, I wrote a lot of fiction, and people would ask me, where do your stories come from? I'd be like, I can't sleep at night, so I make shit up while I'm trying to fall asleep. And it's not exciting. So I want to hear all about the connection between Cactus Mix and interstellar travel.
You know, I really don't have a way to bridge them, and that's the funny thing. The preamble of where this all came from was I was working on an MMO project. I had just come off a previous MMO project before that one, and so needless to say, I was burned out on MMOs. And I was working with the former head of Radical Entertainment. His name is Dave Fracchia, and he's a big to-do in the Canadian game industry. He was involved for the Prototype series. His studio was involved in Destiny, so this guy knows what he's doing. And I was working on this MMO project with him, and we instantly just hit it off in terms of really connected. I mean, in games, there's so many different personalities, and I just was in love with Dave. He's so funny. And so we were chatting one day just about different stuff, projects we're jostling, and I pitched him a concept on this story I was working on, and we heard it, he loved it, and we started working on it next week. So that's really where it came from.
I love it.
So there's an interesting story behind how this game came to be with the people that it came to be with. Right?
Yeah.
Because this is when I first saw this, and I played this game, and I was like, what studio is this? And I was like, The Station by The Station Games. Okay. So can you tell us a little bit about how you guys came together or who you all are?
So the majority of us are just from the AAA circuit. We've got people coming off of Riot, Ubisoft, 3H Studios, Radical, Taurus. It's a little bit of a who's who. And coming off of these projects where, how do I say this politically? There are some projects that you work on and you're not very inspired by the media. Mm-hmm. To give a really quick example, I knew the guy who did a lot of the animation in the Dead Space series. And mm-hmm. I was chatting with him one evening. I'm like, hey, how's it going? And he said, well, it's going okay. I'm in PTSD therapy right now. I'm like, oh, how come? And he's like, well, I just had a daughter and I've been animating dead babies for the last 6 months. So I've been having trouble with life. And I go, yeah, okay. Man. So there is this reality that there's a lot. And I love AAA and I love indie development. There is a reality where there's certain kinds of content that really does not mirror as the reasons as to why you get into game development in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I'm huge on story. I just love story in games. If I don't understand the story, I don't want to work on the project. And that sounds pretentious, but
that
motivates me.
No, that makes total sense.
Yeah. So I had been working on projects that I would say were less than inspiring when it comes to the story, and I was discouraged by that. And I would maybe allude, I won't speak for other people on the team, but I would allude maybe they were in the same position. Because as soon as I pitched them on the idea that, you know what, let's knock out combat, let's knock out anything that is not to do with the central pillar of storytelling, we're just going to focus on story. Let's build a beautiful narrative. And I pitched them on the idea. After reaching out to Dave and getting him as the executive producer of the project, we just reached out to our friends, people who we had worked on in former projects, and within a few days we had our team roster built out. So we were starting production, and it was really funny. We got basically done, and then when you're in the back end of Steam, when you're filling out your forms with PlayStation, they ask you things like, "Okay, what's your studio name?" And I remember leaning back in my chair going, we must have discussed this at some point, right? Like, we must have a studio name. And we didn't. We really came together to say, like, let's tell some, like, a really rich story. And if people like it, we'll keep working together as a team. If people don't, that's okay. And so we didn't come up with a studio name. We just said, like, let's just do this. So we really didn't have a name. We just said, well, let's just take the legal incorporation doc name that we have and go with that. And so people keep saying, like, oh, there's this new studio, The Station Game. And I'm like, not wrong, but you're not right. So at some point we need to circle back and announce that. It was funny. We were working with our PR team, and they said, you know, so what's your studio name? And I said, you know what? That's what I was supposed to do last week. I was supposed to come up with a studio name. So we've been mulling over stuff, and we actually came to the decision as we're launching that, you know what? And this is not a shot at anybody. It's just, I know a lot of studios that don't even have a game made. They're like announcing so-and-so studios, but yeah. they have no sort of portfolio of what they're about, what they're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And so we said, let's not be the studio. Let's not represent who we are, our reputations. Let's not represent what projects we've worked on. Let's instead just say, here, there's a game. It speaks for itself. If you like it, that's amazing. If you don't, that's great. So our goal was to not sort of put ourselves forward as a name and face. I've worked on a couple projects where it's not even the game content that you're interacting with in the circuit. It's just the like a few individual who really have a reputation. And I always find that generally doesn't produce, how do I say this right? It's just to me a little bit backwards. I want the game to speak. So again, we are excited to formalize as a studio based on the results that we're seeing with the station. Mm-hmm. And so we'll be figuring out the name soon.
That was gonna be my question. I mean, because I know I love the game, and Alicia, and I know because Alicia and I talked about it. I won't speak for her, but I think she liked it too a little bit. but other folks everybody else that I've talked to that played the game really enjoyed it. And I was gonna ask, you know, what has, you know, outside of my small circle of friends, right? What has reception been like for you guys on this game?
Oh, well, I mean, we were really pleased. So across all of our platforms, user scores are between 8 and 9. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now, the biggest seller is actually Xbox. I didn't expect that. But we're right now hovering between like a 4.4 and a 4.5 out of 5. So
yeah, the reviews were really good. Yeah. I was excited.
Yeah, it's always really funny. There's certain genres of game that I've worked on. I've always had a rule of thumb that the more artistic a game is, the less deviation in critics and critic reception there is. The more realistic a game is, the more open to interpretation and then like or dislike there is. So yeah, huge spread. We had people say like opening day, like wow. We had reviewers say, you know, really was moved by this. We had other people sending death threats. So you gotta have the spread. You gotta have that wide
variance.
You gotta
expect the death threats, because what's the game industry without that? Am I right?
Right.
Oh, for sure.
No, I think that what you said was really interesting. And can we unpack that just a little bit more? About this idea of, like, art versus realism?
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Where do you think that comes from?
Oh, so, okay. The way I've always looked at it, and this is my perspective, and I'm not speaking for anyone else on my team, I'm not speaking for any of my past clients, but the way I've always interpreted game design is that games have nothing, in my opinion, nothing to do with the physical mechanization and the extension of yourself. So, for instance, when I'm driving a car, that car becomes my legs, right? That mm-hmm. car is the extension of me. Games are not really meant to facilitate that, in my opinion, right? I mean, if I'm using some sort of weird device that lets me control a robot on Mars to do mining, right? It's an entire utilitarian facility. It's a mechanic driven around how well can I execute what I'm trying to do. Games are entirely driven around the artistic nature of something. They're entirely drawn about, let's create an atmosphere, a tone, a voice, a style, a personality, and you get embroiled into that. Now, just as when you meet people, you either like or dislike them. When you meet games, games have a personality and an embodiment of themselves. So I find it's really normal that the more artistic a game is, like, let's take Journey. I've never met someone who didn't like Journey. I've never met someone who didn't like...
Sam doesn't.
there we go. So the reality is when you go for something that's hyper-realistic, you are now comparing yourself. I mean, that's what the station is.
Yeah,
we went
no,
for
this
realism.
Is really important. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, you're just really, the problem is with art, there's, if it's super niche and creating its own perceptual mapping of what it's trying to create, you're not comparing it against anything. You're going, well, it is what it is, and I either like it or I don't like it, but it is what it is. When it's a realism title, you're comparing it against the benchmark of reality, and so it's easier to subjectively go, well, you know what?
Yeah.
If I use my washing machine in real life, it does a load in 30 minutes. This game is 27 minutes. I can't get immersed.
So you're pitting the game against any individual player's lifetime of anecdotal experience.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting perspective that I don't think has been discussed enough. And, you know, it's such an interesting thing, right, with, like, games exist as a media form in a way that no other media does, right? Like, mm-hmm. user reviews are weighed almost as important as professional reviews. And that doesn't happen with, like, movies. That doesn't happen with books, really. You might have things like Goodreads, but you still end up with a different kind of perspective on how those reviews are read. But games are such an interesting personal experience, right? Like, everybody's going to have a different time when they put themselves into that system. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we know that, even if we don't talk about it in those terms. So I think this is a really important discussion that we just don't have enough. But something that's more artistic versus realistic is more abstract and open to interpretation, and we're like, well, okay, that's just your perspective, man. But the realism, we can all kind of get behind, like, this is realistic or not, because we all have a general frame of reference we can compare it to.
And we all come with... Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to say, we all come with different expectations, right? Because, I mean, I have always come to games with certain expectations, and it usually takes me a minute or two to say to myself, okay, you can't put your expectations from past games on this new experience. You have to experience this new experience as a new experience. And I did that when I started playing The Station, because I started playing it for like the first 20 minutes of the game or so. I was like totally on edge. I was like, when is something going to jump out at me and I'm going to have to start fighting? And then I was like, wait, this is not that kind of game. So, I mean, and then like when you go into the common area, like the sitting area, and you look up and there is that figure in the window above, right? I spent like the next half an hour like looking around corners, right? Because yeah. I have this expectation of what is going to happen in a game like this, and because I came with those expectations and I couldn't immediately let go of them, that was a big part of the reason that I said to myself, I need to replay this game so that I can experience this narrative in the way that it was meant to be experienced, and not come into it with, oh my God, I'm going to have to fight everything and be totally on edge and missing a lot of the nuance that I missed the first. I know I'm always expecting to fight stuff, right?
I know.
But missing a lot of the nuance that I missed that first time through, because the story is amazing. I'm sorry, Kevin, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, and thank you so much for your lovely words. I really appreciate that. You're really hitting on it exactly the way I would define it as well. A game is what it is. I've always struggled. I once was speaking to Alex. He was the head of design at Ubisoft for Assassin's Creed, and he was talking about how, you know, you can either like a story or you don't like it, but there's no such thing as a good story or a bad story. The story is what it is. A game is what it is. It's not necessarily a bad or a good game. If it works, it's a game, and you may not like it, or you don't like it, you know, it's really on those terms. And I still haven't really decided if I agree with that mandate yet, but you are correct in the sense that one of the biggest things we have had is, you know, during playtesting, it was really hard to set expectations. I mean, I wasn't in charge of the playtesting. I wasn't running the events, but we would have people sit down, and the goal was, in any playtesting scenario, don't, you know, give them what you would give a consumer in terms of information, and let it go. Don't try and dictate. Don't try and control things. Don't try and guide the experience. And so we had people sit down, and I was watching the gameplay footage, and these people were playing it, bless their hearts, as a first-person shooter. They were, like, ducking in like, behind walls, and, like, it was really interesting. So, you know, the style that you bring into the game helps dictate the experience, or hinders it. I'm not sure which one. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that, I hate to say, just say, it's interesting, it's so basic, but that you're so aware of those potential levels of player engagement, right? I feel like there are, like, we've interviewed a lot of game developers on the podcast over the years, and some of them are very cognizant of that idea of, like, what is the person going to come with already in place to this game? And some are not. Some are like very, you know, this is my message, this is what I want to get across, and it is what it is. But the real answer, if there is an answer, is in the middle, right? Because it's a combination of what the player brings to the experience and what the game has to offer. And it's what happens when those two things mesh. And I think that what happens here, I spent a lot of time reading the Steam reviews of this game. I've been reading a lot of reviews lately. I read the Xbox reviews, I read the Steam reviews. But lately I found reviews just in general very fascinating. And there was a huge split between people who predicted the ending and people who didn't. And there was like a fight on Steam between these two
that
factions.
That was a good fight. That was
I know. And people were like, I don't know, it was really predictable to me. And people were like, well, just because you predicted it doesn't mean it was predictable. But it was really funny, the things that people hinge their prediction or lack thereof on. Mm-hmm. Like, what I thought was going on was not it. I was really suspicious of one of the characters. And I was like, this motherfucker is causing everything. until I got to the paintings, and then I changed my mind.
Really?
Yeah, but just watching all these different people and, like, what they brought into the game with them and how it framed their assumptions was really fascinating to me. Because I think there's a lot there that's worth unpacking, and it's how we read these clues. Because the game has a variety of clues that can be read in different ways. One thing that I thought was interesting is that everybody found Aiden, who's, like, the engineer, mm-hmm. relatively sympathetic. But why people found him sympathetic was very, very changeable, right? There was no firm foundation there. There were a lot of reasons to empathize with Aiden, but what people selected was fascinating. And part of it was based on, like, what they encountered in the game, and part of it was based on, like, how they personally identified with him. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And part of it was based on both. So, I don't know. I mean, it's just... It's almost impossible to estimate how a game is going to be read once it's released into the world.
Absolutely.
And I think that it's really cool with this game in particular, which positions the player in such a both connected and non-connected space. Like, you're not actually part of the action, but the action is happening around you, and you have to read it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, you hit on two things there I'll touch on. So, I mean, character design, I knew that character design was finished when... we would run our playtests, and we would run them like D&D style. So I would basically, you know, be LARPing hard and just taking groups of people and running them through. I would, you know, head on down to a local university and just say, anyone who studies game design, come to this class, get in there. And it was a lot of fun because we would do then post-surveys, and we would say, let me just ask you a series of questions. I knew it was done. I knew we were done with the narrative when there was an almost equal distribution of people who liked every type of character. And it was really funny, because the goal from the very beginning was, we don't want to tell a story, we want to show a story. And I think there's a very big difference. I think you guys probably know the difference. And I was really frustrated by the amount of people who wanted something really explicit. They would, you know, right after the gameplay go, all right, so who did it? You know, it's a mystery game, so who did it? And I would say, exactly, who did it? Who do you think did it? And the whole idea was to pose shades of gray, not 50 shades, because that's taken by someone else, but... we really wanted to focus on what kind of person identifies with what kind of character. And so by digging into certain kinds of clues, by digging into certain kinds of traits of a person in these characters, you start to identify with them. And so by the end, we were having, like, we would ask, who's your favorite character and why? And it was basically a 30-30 split on all the characters.
So I've got
wanted to laugh during that, but I was coughing, so I was muted on every possible channel.
That's totally fair. I'm never sure when these jokes are going to go well, so I was terrified. I was like, oh, tough crowd, move on.
No, it was funny.
No, Sam, hang on.
Okay.
So the audience can't see this right now, but Kev is on camera, and he's standing, and he's so intent about what he's saying, and I love watching him right now, and I wish that everybody could see him, because he's so into talking about this game, and, like, the way people identify with these characters is kind of cool. I just wanted to make that observation.
Well, thank you.
it makes me want to go back and play it. I mean, I already wanted to play it again because I missed some things, but it makes me want to go back and play it again for other reasons, to, like, read a little bit more deeply into these characters. I really liked the captain. And I often identify, of course, more strongly with female characters, but I really liked the nuance that went in her. Like, she was jealous and bitter and angry, but also really cognizant of what was going on and the wider implications. And there was so much there that was worth unpacking, and I felt like I only barely scratched the surface because, like, anytime I saw something or I heard something, I would run off in another direction and I would miss, like, 100 things. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how you played it, Sam, but it might be really interesting to compare.
So, I had my own, like, you were like, Mila was bitter and jealous. I was like, Mila was justified in everything she did.
Oh, I'm not saying she wasn't justified, but I think that looking at her interactions with the other characters and all of the wider implications of what was going on, like, this was a game that was not afraid to talk about capitalism and the effects of capitalism,
yes,
right? Which is something that doesn't happen very often.
Mm-hmm.
But it just becomes part of the narrative. Like, it's not the central point of the narrative. It's just part of this world that's constructed. And it makes it feel very robust and realistic that there are all these different factors that you can consider, right? If you want to focus more on, like, Mila and her personal relationships, you can. If you want to focus on the wider systems and, like, the political situation, you can.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to focus on the combination of those things and how they intersect, you can. This game can be read a dozen or more different ways, and
yeah,
that was amazing.
Thank you. There's been a couple instances where people reach out to me and they go, you know what? The way you injected that narrative to really, you know, take it to the man and to really be, you know, such a left-wing commentary. I was like, oh, okay. And then I've had other people come forward and be like, you know, your ultra-right-wing views are not welcome on this channel, but I respect your right to say them. And I said, oh geez. So, I've quickly learned that I'm terrified. And I'm grateful that I didn't really plan for any of this. I was just excited by the story. You know, the themes, you're totally right, guys, though. I mean, you can go micro or macro, and I think it's fascinating. Like, I was the one who wrote it, but yet I'm still fascinated by it. Like, my favorite thing was the leaving the interpretation of these characters, right? So, I mean, Mila, you either have to decide, you can't go in the middle here. You have to pick that either she's an insubordinate captain who could have led to the entire situation that happened on board, right? When she's asked very explicitly to do something by email by her superior, and you don't know what that order was, right? So she either was insubordinate and led to the situation that happened, or she was an altruistic, moral person who rejected authoritarianism. You have to make the decision.
Yeah.
And I find that fascinating because people, depending on the traits they bring into the game, they identify with someone. And so I love hearing, you know what, I hated it when she did this, I loved it when she did that. But then at the macro stage, I love the themes that I've never seen explored in sci-fi before, which is what we were so excited to do, was look at, I would say the main one is intergalactic imperialism, right? You discover an alien civilization. What's the next step? Do you grant them human rights? Like, does an alien have a human right? How do you explore all, like, stewardship, the idea of they don't know you're there?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with that, right? What's your role as an advocate of their success, and how do you define success? All of these questions were what I was really excited to explore.
Yeah,
Sam, I want to go off book here.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yes, you may.
Okay, so, like, we had some questions, but, like, fuck it, right? my question for you is that my secret theory that is relatively unpopular is that a game only exists when it's played by a player. How do you think that, how would you weigh that idea in terms of the station?
That's a great question. I think it goes pretty far, but the only thing I think I would maybe perhaps add as a dialogue is, I don't necessarily consider this to be a game. I consider this to be an experience or a narrative.
Mm-hmm.
I throw people into, when we were focusing on this, we were really trying to nail down what the puzzle sort of overhead broad arching theme
mm-hmm.
is. And we picked intuitive problem solving. These puzzles are not, oh no, I got to hack the door, so I better play Pong for an hour. Like, you know, it doesn't, we tried to always make sure you were immersed into first, the actual gameplay and the story narrative, so it makes sense. Second, we tried to intertwine you into the characters. We tried to immerse you. When you're solving a mechanical problem,
right,
you're meant to be guided into the process.
Like,
of
you actually have to look at the engine and figure out, like, okay, where are all the wires connected?
Yes.
Like, that was good. That was a puzzle that made sense. It wasn't just a puzzle for the sake of being a puzzle.
Yeah. And so the second component was the fact that The way everyone has their own process. Everyone has their own process for writing stories and for approaching this. Mine was, I don't know. I don't know if this is mainstream or not. My sister works on Broadway, and so I spend a lot of time talking to her about how she approaches character. But I tried to do a lot of method direction and method, not acting, but method writing. And so what we did, and you'll see in the documents that I shared out to you, is that, you know, a third of the game design documents are focused around the characters, are focused around getting to know a three-dimensional character, everything from their Myers-Briggs to what motivates them, what's their history, how do you wrap up a character into an entire entity? How do you create a person? And so then I would spend my evenings having a glass of wine, putting on music, and trying to talk to this person, trying to see how they would organize their lives, how they would view money, how they would view relationships, how they would review power, and fleshing out a character into a three-dimensional way. And so, like I said, you know, 15 minutes ago, we didn't want to tell a story, we wanted to show a story. And so what that meant was we set, you know, the whole game was one giant storytelling machine. You know, you walk into a room and it's a living scene. Mm-hmm. We're not, you know, you're not walking over to a computer and they go, I am a mechanic. We've really tried to flesh out what that meant for a person, what kind of motivations they would have in spite of their grievances with life. Mm-hmm. So I hear what you're saying in terms of a game is only a game when the player's injected. I think I'm paraphrasing that. In this case, I don't know. I think this is almost like a living story and the player becomes witness to it.
No, I really love that answer. It makes me super happy.
So when we start talking about the ways that we experience it, right? Because for me, it started out with the characters, right? And I was really into the characters. I was really into Mila. I think probably because I probably saw a lot of myself in Mila and I was like, yeah, I can see this, and I would have done something similar, right? So as we started to figure the characters out, and I'm not even gonna talk about Silas,
right,
because Silas was just too well written, I think, because Silas was not my favorite. We're just gonna leave it at that.
I thought Silas was responsible for everything. Please continue.
It's like, I don't
for
like
while,
this dude.
I thought
it must
that.
Be him.
Yes.
It must be him.
Yeah. Until I got to the lab.
Well, and that's the thing, right? And then when you start to get into the actual mystery part of it, right? When you go through the labs and you start to see, like, you start to see the sketches and you start to read the lab notes and you start to see things like in the lab, and I was like, okay, so there were I'm trying not to. So I was like, well, this is not a spoiler, right? And I was like, that's a human eye, right? And then we start to, like, go through, and then I was like, but that's not, you know, that's not a human appendage, right? So, and you start to go through, and then, because I streamed this the first time I played it. The first time I played it through, I streamed it.
I wish I had now.
And one of the mods in my stream channel is finishing her PhD in microbiology.
yeah. Nicole, what's up?
Yes, Nicole, right? So she was there, and so things that I would miss, she would be like, go back. And then she'd be like, that's this. And I was like, oh. So I had a little help in figuring things out as we went along.
But if I just can say really quickly, a lot of the scientific shit, those were really good clues. Like, y'all did a very good job of seeding just enough, but not too much. Which I think a lot of games fail at. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah. I have to give a shout out for that too. I really did not want to be that guy who sort of said, like, it happened because of space wizards. So I really wanted to make sure we had the scientific backing to make this be plausible. So I actually ended up reaching out to the Canadian Space Society and saying, hey, we're making a thing. Do you want to jump in and sort of pick it apart with us? And so they went through everything that we were working on and built out a pretty comprehensive audit of everything that we would need to make this backed by what our understanding of science is. Mm-hmm.
That's so great. I'm sorry. I'm just really excited right now.
No, I get really excited when devs actually go out and find, like, factual information instead of relying on space wizards. Right?
Or Wikipedia.
or Wikipedia, yes. Right? All of those things, because for those of us who, like, even those of us who know, like, a little about science, right? When we see something that's, like, a glaring inaccuracy. It's just like, really, you couldn't have done better than that. So to have that there in that way is one of the things that made it such a great, there are all of these little things in the station that come together to make it such a great game. And that's definitely one of them.
Well, thank you. I'm glad it paid off.
Yeah, it was amazing. Please don't stop doing that. keep doing that. I want to go back to something Alicia said earlier, because you've been talking about this since you finished playing the game and you like immediately texted me and was like, I gotta ask about the paintings.
The paintings. Oh my god! I swear I screenshotted every single painting in Simon's room. Okay, so there's a reason why though. I paint not very well, but I've been painting for a couple of years, and when I see really interesting paintings in the world, I always take pictures of them. The paintings in Simon's room were so good, and so they fit really well with like his internal puzzle and what was going on with him, but also they just really spoke to his character. And I was very suspicious of Simon until I got to his space, and I was like, I need to reconsider this. I just want to know where you guys got inspiration for Simon's paintings. I'm sorry, Sam. I just keep stepping on you. Say something, and I'm like, oh, wait. I have like 400 things I have to say.
No, that's awesome. I get excited. So it's actually a pretty cool situation. Mm-hmm. So my father is a painter, and so he lives in Ottawa, but he spends a lot of time in southern France doing painting. And so when I was trying to construct this character of Silas, and you know the kind of intellectual that he was. You know, my father is a man who fills his house with beautiful art. And so you walk around his house and it's just a gallery. And so I reached out to him and I said, hey, I would love it if we could feature some of your art. And he does galleries and he does all these art shows all the time. And so could you build a portfolio for me of your favorite abstract art that really blends into these emotions and characteristics? And so he compiled all of them and that's his art.
That's so great.
That's pretty amazing.
That makes me really happy. Like, I can't remember the last time I was this excited about something. Well, tell him that I, at least, really appreciated his work because it was beautiful. And it really helped communicate the complexity of Simon. Like, I liked Mila and I liked Aiden, but I really felt like Simon was a fully realized character. Like, there was a lot going on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me, I really fell in love with the character when I was working. So that's actually my sister's boyfriend, the voice actor who did that work. He is a like unbelievably rising talent in Canada. When he was in the booth and we were doing a recording, he just took this character and just fused it into reality. It was unreal. Mm-hmm. To me, it was the audio acting that just exploded that character.
That was pretty amusing. The voice actor, right? Because when we were streaming, there were people in chat. They were like, "Is that Tom Hanks?" And I was like, "No, this isn't Tom Hanks." I'm like, "It's clearly not Tom Hanks." They were like, "I think I just want to read Tom Hanks as this character." But I love, and that's another thing. The voice acting was so well done in this. Mila's voice. To me, and I, like I said, I think it's just because mm-hmm. Mila was just the character for me. But Mila's voice to me was one that did an amazing job of letting us know what she was feeling at the moment, right? And in the moment. So it was like, okay, so there's a moment of panic. Here's a moment where you can definitely sense the anxiety or the anger or you know, even a little bit of hostility from time to time. But mm-hmm. specifically the way that she is not as unmalleable as you initially think she is. She's a little unmalleable with Silas, right? Yeah, you know, because they've got history, right?
Yeah,
and then we learn at the end that history may have rewritten itself, put it that way. But just like even in the way that she responds to and starts to respond to Aiden, right? Aiden, the engineer. when she changes and she sits down and she has a drink with him. And then, or we learned that from the glowy thought bubbles, right? Or the glowy voice bubbles, the voice recordings. And then when you go into the room that has the conference table and you see the notes, and she's like scratched out a note that says, you know, you can't drink on the job. And then it's scratched out and it says, you can't drink so much like during the day. Right. So she starts to understand what is going on, you know, not only with herself, but with those around her. So she becomes a much more sympathetic character herself, as time goes on. These characters are amazing. And I really loved to see, even in this fairly brief, I mean, because if you play straight through and you're not like looking at everything, you can finish it in 2 hours, but you miss a whole lot. So I don't recommend that for anyone. But when you're talking about having a fuller experience, you're looking at double that, right? Because to look at everything. But when you go through and you see this evolution of the characters themselves, right? You see growth within these characters in a 3 or 4 hour period, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, Alex, the voice actress of Mila, was a friend of mine I went to, I did some schooling with at one point. I know you're not supposed to do this, but when I was listening to the character of Mila in my head, I instantly heard this woman's voice, mm-hmm. and she nailed it for me. We threw her into the booth just to like say, you know, potential character, what do you think? And she was, to me, a ringer. She really drew the emotion out. And it was really incredible to watch her process, because there were times where she would come out of the booth sobbing. And it felt so real. And, you know, I got to tell one funny story. So we were doing the recording. It was the very last audio log. The very last audio log in the game by Mila. Mm-hmm. I think you know the intensity we're talking, right?
Yes.
So we needed to bring the tension up a bit. And it was the end of the day. We were all a little bit tired. So this to me was the moment that characterized the entire production. I'll never forget it. So I'm in the audio recording booth. We got an audio engineer on my right. I have two producers with me. And I'm chatting with Alex while she's in the booth. And this is a scene where obviously she needs to convey a sense of panic halfway through as the tension really starts to rise.
Yeah.
And so there was this one part where we tried different like sort of role-playing to really build out that tension. And finally, the executive producer, Dave, who is a fantastic audio coach and voice director, said, you know what, like, let's just run it again on repeat. And so he went over to the door of the booth where she was in and started pounding on the door and like swearing at her and like saying he's gonna break in and like kill her. It was crazy. So I was terrified, because I look over at my audio engineer and he's got his head like just buried and he's like panicking. I look over at my producer, he's turned into the wall, like just in the wall, just hiding, cowering. I'm looking at the footage of Alex in the booth, and she's like legitimately panicking. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, I'm gonna go to jail. The union's gonna kill me. Like this is it. The career's done. People were walking past the hallway, like looking through the window, being like, oh, we'll just call security right now. So that was how we got that scene.
Wow.
Well, it worked, but shit.
I remember
you were paying for that therapy.
I remember we opened the door and I was like, oh, okay, we're done. We're done for the day. Thank you. And I was terrified. Luckily, that was her style of getting into character as well. But oh my
like,
gosh!
Yeah.
That
also,
was tense.
We love you and please don't sue.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
So, okay. I know Alicia has another question, but
I do. I have a million questions, but
well,
one really big.
I was
one.
Like, we're not gonna ask him a million questions. That would just be rude. And I totally forgot what it was. Go ahead and ask your question, because that story just threw me all off.
I know. It's like, whoa. No. Okay. So if you. For us, at least, the history of game studies is broken down into two things. There's a lot of other things, but these are the two big ones. There's ludology, which is like the game is the thing, the mechanics, the system, whatever. And then there's narratology, which is just story. And the meaning of story, as though these things can't be like one, right? Mm-hmm. So here's what I want to ask you is, and it's a complicated question, and I'm sorry. I'm just going to spring this on you. how do you feel that story and mechanics are functioning here as one? And I want to ask you this specifically because you seem really knowledgeable about how the different levels of the game are working together. And it's not something that actually often gets talked about by game designers. How is the story feeding the mechanics and vice versa? Why is this a game and not a movie?
Yeah, that's a great question, Alicia. So my way of approaching it, maybe, again, very divergent from a lot of other folks, but the way I view it is you have to put the center of the game. You have to define what you're trying to do. You have to define what you're actually trying to do with your game. And so for me, it was, let's put story as our cornerstone, as our pillar. The game is story. Story is king. And so when you're designing mechanics, it's actually very easy. You throw the story on the whiteboard, right? And you don't need to design anything. You actually just let it speak to you. You just let the experience speak to you. So if I'm telling a story and I want people to be immersed, I want people to be able to hear voices, they need to be able to read, they need to be able to process what's going on, they need to be able to absorb it. Well, do I want people chasing you? Do I want people to be frightening you and you more worried about watching what's behind you than you are about getting immersed into the text or the audio that you're listening to? Probably not. So the majority of our mechanics, I mean, I don't know if you guys played Alien Isolation. Mm-hmm. Loved Alien Isolation. I don't remember a single thing about the story because I was constantly trying to remember how much fuel was in my flamethrower to kill the xenomorph, right? So the problem to me is when you have a mismatch of what the mechanics are and what the story you're trying to tell is. So for me, I love exploring places. I absolutely love understanding the space I'm in. So for me, we again, put the story on the board. That's the mandate. Then the behaviors spring forth from that. Well, the story is something that we're not going to tell you what it is. We're going to show it to you what it is. So find the story. So that meant you're opening things. You're opening drawers. You're reading things. You're picking things up. You're really exploring things. You're reaching out and grabbing things. You're inspecting things.
Every individual book that had a different title.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was amazing, by the way.
And so, the problem is when you say to yourself story, and story is going to be shown, not told, and then you don't do things like add individual book titles. And I don't know if you noticed this, but I spent hours writing book titles based on where you were in the game. So if you're in Silas's room, if you're in Mila's room, you're reading content.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that not only fleshes out more about the character in terms of what she's reading, but it really speaks to where we're at in society when you're reading books of that narrative, of that style. So to me, the mechanics spring forth based on what the story is asking for. And that was what we tried to do in every instance. We tried to make it so puzzles were based around you having to discover what the puzzle is. We tried to train you very early on that we're not going to hold your hand and say, go do this, go do that. We let you stumble your way through like you're in charge. You need to figure out what's going on, what's the price you're willing to pay to get through that door, how much are you going to dawdle around looking for stuff like that? Mm-hmm. And we tried to, the behavioral cycle is very simple. You enter a new room, we expose you to dark areas. You have to find the mystery. So you're going into different little spots in the maintenance room, and you can see Aiden's written rules of how you play the Espial drinking game. Hiding things all around the station so that it's meant to be uncovered.
I love that drinking game so much. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So it's really, to me, as simple as just saying, what is the game asking for? The game is asking you to tell a story. It's trying to let you explore it. So how do you do that, and what mechanics best implement that?
Yeah, and I noticed the books, and that was really interesting. Like, for example, with Silas, right? At the beginning, you've got more books that are just kind of feeding into his scholarship and feeding into whatever he's working on. But about midway through the game, you start to find the books that have a lot to do with ethics. And I was like, oh, so Silas is not maybe as bad as I want him to be. But still, he's Silas, and I can't back off from what I from what I originally thought. So, I mean, like I said, I think it is these like little things that come together that if you spend the time like paying attention to the little things in the game, like the book titles, like the paintings,
Pluto narrative harmony,
you get all of this, right? And you get a larger read on the individual characters as well, outside of what the story is that's on the surface and what interactions you even see between other characters on the SBO, right? But you get the inner workings, like what they're thinking by, say, what they're reading, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Everything in the game adds to something. Like, it's all, there are puzzles, but the entire quilt is one big puzzle that reveals something about what's going on.
Yeah, and, you know, the real thing to me was the set pieces. Building the story by you actually seeing what the space was used by the characters to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for us, it actually came down to, it's easy to write narrative when you understand the characters. It's easy to write dialogue between people and have funny quips and jokes and rhymes and stuff like that. But to me, it's under, you know, I would start reaching out to people who I knew were very similar to these characters and just be like, hey, I'm going to come over and just look through your stuff. And it was really fun because I would start to meet characters very similar to some of these people. And in fact, they actually injected, you know, reverse. They started to inject themselves into the story when I really came to understand how they were motivated. And so, you know, when you look at Aiden, the way his room and his work is merged, you know, there is no separation.
There's none. And his room is so sparse compared to the other two rooms.
We tried to throw his room directly against the maintenance. And there's a lot of allegory there in the sense that he never stops working. He's always trying to drown himself in work to get rid of what he's thinking about.
I feel it.
We really tried to delve into that because there's nothing more uninspiring to me than when you say, let me tell you about him. You need to get to know him yourself.
So, yeah, like, Mila and Silas had relaxation spaces and Aiden didn't, and I noticed this, and I felt, like, really bad for Aiden. I was like, God damn, this man doesn't even get a fucking break.
Well,
like, the ship
little,
is breaking
he
around him, he's
quarter.
Worried about his family back home, there's all this stuff going on, and, like, his work never stops.
Well, he had a little
Except
corner.
In this moment, in this little corner in the engineering room where he has a drinking game.
No.
Exactly.
Not the engineering game, the corner in his quarters, right, where he had the punching bags and there were the weights on the floor.
Yes.
That was it, right? But let me just say, in talking about Aiden, right, and I have a thing for, you know, I have a 9-year-old. I don't deal well with children.
Oh my
children.
God.
You know what I'm talking about, right? So I don't deal well with children in games. And this is not the story of...
No, I started to cry.
Not necessarily the story of his daughter, right? But the plushie in the airlock. Hurt my heart.
The fucking plushie. Like, I didn't even look at it. I didn't even, like, examine it. I just looked at it. I stood there and I looked at it and I was like... God damn.
The plushie in
this
the
is Aiden's daughters.
I was that too. The whole team, that's like a collective like sore spot. Like you mentioned that. You're just like, yes, never forget.
It hurt my heart, yeah.
There was a Vancouver chapter of a video game club that they just all get together every week and play games, and they reached out to me saying, hey, we're playing your game, do you wanna come join? I couldn't join them, but they were calling me every time they got stuck or wanted to chat about something. And so when they entered the engineering room and they found the plushie and then they found, you know, the other thing that's a major thing,
mm-hmm.
they end up,
yeah.
they took the plushie and they put that with that character and they just left it there and they sent me a photo of it. And I was like, oh, there's the feels right there. Oh my gosh.
So many feels. I stood there for like, I don't know, probably 5 minutes real time. And I just looked at that plushie and I was like, I'm going to examine this and it's going to make me feel a whole lot of things. But I already know what it is, and I can figure out what it means.
Yep.
And I'm really upset right now.
Well, there's a picture and a note in Aiden's room that explains it early on.
There's a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff about Aiden. Like, the thing in the engineering room that's like, the days until Daddy comes home. And I'm like, fuck. Right in the fields. There were so many different items. And this is what I'm talking about with this idea of, like, ludonarrative harmony, and so many games lack this.
Yeah.
And, like, look, I mean, I'm not trying to tell you that your game is not perfect. All games have flaws, right? But I think where the station really succeeds is in this idea of ludonarrative harmony that a lot of games don't enjoy. And that the puzzles and the movement and what you do and how you react and how you feel really comes together. And that's a special thing.
Yeah.
So if you're out there and you're listening to the podcast and you're like, I don't know, do I spend the money on the station?
Yes
is the answer. And people are like, I don't know, it doesn't have really replayability. That's bullshit because you're not going to be perfect on your first way through.
Yeah.
The big thing from the replay, and you're very generous, thank you. The big thing that we tried to push, and I totally sympathize, there's a lot of people who want to buy, you know, Factorio or PUBG or League of Legends, and they want a game that they can grind through, and I love those kinds of games. I also love story-driven narrative games. I try and get my hands on every story I can play, because to me, those are those are the thing that lasts forever.
Yeah.
And the real thing that I tried to do with the replayability of the game is we wanted to tell a story that would take 2-3 hours to go through, but you would spend 2-3 weeks thinking about. And the real drawn out process of you being able to think about stuff is we stitched in around, I can personally count around 7 or 8 conspiracies, right? Things that could have been the reason why the mystery, like the answers to the mystery, 7 or 8 different reasons. And my favorite is, I'm already sort of emotionally putting the game to rest in my heart, but the thing that I could do forever is sit and chat with people as they tell me who did it, why, and how they justify it, because there's so many ways to interpret what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, we're not going to keep you all night, and I'm going to ask you this question. And this is a question that is like a non-question, but I always ask. If there was one thing that you wish we would have asked you about the game, about the process, about the Station Game Company. So if it was one thing you wish we would have asked you, but we didn't.
Tell us everything.
What would it be?
You know, you actually asked some of the best questions. This was a fantastic conversation because I can tell you guys actually were feeling what was being stitched into the game. The amount of times I've had conversations, which I don't mind having, about the technical implementation, about the framework of Unity and the current state of photogrammetry and what texture optimization allows you to do. That's cool, but I really enjoy talking the story, which is what you guys nailed. I would say the one thing that I'm usually asked by people would be what's next for our team.
Yep.
And what do we want to do with this? So our goal was with this game, this game would normally take around 18 months to produce. It's really not, as you know, it's not a very long title. And so we actually spent 4 years developing it. Well, I personally was involved for 4 years. And it was because we wanted to define a new framework for how we're going to approach game production. The whole idea is that we want to take AAA level quality, so the same level of stringent control that we run in quality assurance for AAA games, the same procedure of doing level gray boxing, everything. We wanted to do it at the highest level of quality. We wanted to make sure that we were delivering something at the highest value we could. So the reason it took so long to produce this title was because we were not just designing the game, we were designing the process to make games like this.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're so excited to do is start to dig into this process and really start to pump out titles along this style. Because the thing that's really been affirming for me is that there is a hunger for rich story in games.
Yes.
There is a real desire for people to think about some of the more darker morality in life.
Yes.
And, you know, there was a very clear thing I tried to stay away from. There's many different perspectives and many different faith backgrounds on our team. I'm no exception. And I wanted to be able to have conversations in this game that were at what I would call the lowest common denominator. And what I mean by that is, when someone's upset, when a character's upset, they talk, they don't swear, they don't get violent, they don't hit people. When two people are in love, they express that love through talking to each other. They're not making love in the closet somewhere. you know, there is no gore, there is no swearing in the entire script. We tried to maintain a level of propriety that allows people of any kind of perspective to play this game in a safe way,
mm-hmm.
that they can, you know, interact with these themes. And these themes are, some of them are very common, some of them are very progressive. We try to focus on how we can make a game that all kind of ages can work with. You know, we are rated PEGI 12 and teen. So
yeah.
We've really tried to maintain a broad audience of who can interact with this. And that was our real mandate, and I really hope we hit it.
Yeah, I'm going to sit down with my eldest, who just turned 10, and we're going to play it together.
Yeah. Yeah, I could. I mean, this is definitely something that my daughter's almost 10, and this is definitely something because she likes mysteries as well, right? And this is definitely something I feel like I could sit down with her and play as well. So I think you guys nailed it.
Discuss things like the periodic table, right? The layered periodic table and like how that was used will be really fascinating.
Yeah,
we might just have to have you back.
This has been this has definitely been one of my favorite podcasts I've been on for the launch of this title. So, yeah, that would be a pleasure.
So, yeah, thanks so much for one. Thanks for making this game. Two, thanks so much for you know agreeing to come on the podcast and talking to us about it and being so darn entertaining while you did it.
Like I said, I wish everybody could just see him walking around and like gesturing.
So I guess with that, it's going to bring us to the end of this episode. And thanks so much to Kevin Harwood for talking to us about this game. Everybody go, if you haven't already played this game, you need to play it, right now. So as soon as the podcast is over, I want you to go to your Xbox. I want you to go to your PlayStation. I want you to go to Steam. I want you to buy it and I want you to play it.
And can I just say really quickly, one of the best reviews I saw said that for the price of a movie ticket, I got something a little bit better than a movie.
Yeah.
Take that with you. You get something that's like a movie but interactive and that makes you think more than a movie will.
Absolutely.
So if you want to waffle over the price, take this moment and say, this is something I can insert myself into for the price of a movie, which you can't usually do. So it's worth it.
More than. So that is going to bring us to the end of episode 169. So until next time when we hit up episode 170, where we have some other exciting things going on, but we're not going to tell you what just yet. We'd like to say to everybody, stay warm, stay dry, stay safe. And as always, 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 my friends, game on.
Game on.